I was on a plane flying from Holland, Michigan to back to San Diego. This is years ago, and I sat down in the flight, two seats on both sides, a smaller plane, and I'm sitting next to an F-A-18 Navy aviator, a fighter pilot. And for me, I've always thought that planes were extremely cool, and so I thought, I'm sitting next to a fighter pilot. This is great. You know, I'm going to pump him with all the questions I possibly can. And so we got along just fine. And as the flight got along and they served us our drinks and our little snacky things because they don't give you anything hardly anymore, the in-flight movie started. And as it so happened, the in-flight movie was Mr. Holland's Opus. Now, if you've ever seen the movie, I would recommend the movie to anyone, but especially to those that are engaged with people in their lines of work, because I think it's extremely inspiring. But at the end of the movie, it's incredibly emotional. That the opus actually, I'm going to give away, this is a spoiler alert, but the opus is the imprint of his life on the lives of all of these kids. This is his opus. And he's a music teacher, and all of these people are playing the symphony that he wrote, and it's beautiful. Well, as this is crescendoing in the movie, I'm just like a hot mess, just, you know, I'm just crying. It's just puffy face, tears just pouring down my face. I'm thinking, I'm sitting next to a fighter pilot. This is great. This is so manly. And I thought, I'm going to chance to look over at this guy. I look over at him. I see a singular tear coming down. And I could read on his face, do not show any emotion. Emotion is weakness. Do not show any of this. But this incredibly emotive scene, and it's getting to him, but he is holding it in. I think he's typical of a lot of us with regard to emotion, that we feel uncomfortable with our emotions, that we're afraid that somehow if we're emotional that people will view us as weak, especially if you're a male, that people will view as weak. We're concerned if our emotions seem out of control. In fact, I think a lot of times the way I would describe it is we think that if we let our emotions actually out, it's sort of like letting the cat out of the bag, and it turns out to be a lion, and the lion goes, "Rawr!" And you know, it consumes everything and us and never can be put back in the bag again. And so we're afraid, and so we keep the cat in the bag. Not really realizing that you say to the cat, "Rawr! Stop that." The cat goes, "Meow." Because you are in charge of your emotions. You're in charge of your emotions. Emotions can take us into soaringly positive ways, places and devastatingly deep and sorrowful and sad places. Sorrow and these feelings of sorrow and sadness and pain are in what's going on in this chapter of the book of Job this week by the guy Job whose life has been devastated. But all kinds of things these same feelings are associated with. They're associated with loss and death and chronic illness and cancer. They're associated with injuries and disabilities that debilitate us over a long haul. It gets us when we're fired from a job and then we're jobless for a time. It can get a hold of us when we're depressed, both clinically and just find ourselves in a place of depression. It happens, as I'm thinking about this, it happens for people who have long-term sexual identity dysphoria. That means that they just can't figure out who they are sexually, and this is torment and struggle for them. It happens with addictions and pornography and prolonged struggles and divorce and breakups and bankruptcy and failing out of school or failing a test or pick your poison. I'm just getting going. There's so many places in our lives where we can get these feelings that seem to overwhelm us. And so what we're going to see in this chapter of the book of Job, this chapter where Job basically just vents it all out, which we're calling in this message, being honest to God. That's what Job is doing this morning. What we're going to see is that God invites us to be honest with him and with others, with our pain and all of our emotions, and by doing so, we find equilibrium and connection and support. One more time. That God invites us to be honest with him and others, with our pain and our emotions, and to find in doing that an equilibrium of self and of life, a connection with others and the support of others. Now, if you're familiar at all with the book of Job, Job's life is crushed through no fault of his own. He has been completely dismantled, and his suffering is caused by, oddly enough, the infiltration or the piercing of the invisible realm into the visible realm. That's what's caused it. He is a casualty of this. The next step of he's lost everything, even his 10 children, and then now his health is in the crosshairs. He's covered with puffy, pussy boils head to toe. He's in complete and total misery and devastation. Three friends come to comfort him. His wife chimes in. He still has her. She says, curse God and die. He will have none of it. But Job in this, he now, finally he speaks up and he vents out his pain. And what we see in his pain is, oddly, some curious and helpful emotional literacy. Now, as we go through this, I want to ask you to stay in the hunt, because I believe that these are important as we step through it, to look at the things that people go through and even find out that when we're going through these things, it's normal. And so with that, let's jump in to verse 1 of Job 3. After this, that is, after his three friends came and after his health has gone all to pieces, it says, after this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. He said, may the day of my birth perish, and the night that said, a boy is conceived, that day, may it turn to darkness. May God above not care about it. May no light shine on it. May gloom and darkness claim it once more. May a cloud settle over it. May blackness overwhelm it that night. May thick darkness seize it. May it not be included in among the days of the year, nor be entered into any of the months. May that night be barren. May no shout of joy be heard in it. May those who curse days, like pagan diviners, those who curse days, curse that day. Those who are ready to rouse Leviathan, the sea monster. May its morning stars become dark. May it wait for daylight in vain and not see the first rays of dawn. For it did not shut the doors on the womb on me, of the womb on me, to hide trouble from my eyes. This is what I would call serious birthday regret. He said, basically, if I had not been born, I wouldn't feel this. If I just wouldn't have been born. But he will not curse God. He will not curse others. He will not put the blame on anyone, but he does not hide his pain. He doesn't hide his pain. And I think noting here as we're walking through this, it's important that, like Job, our current pain can color everything we see. That our current status, our current state of heart, we can be so down that it taints everything that we see. I think most of us have been in a place where we simply couldn't see beyond the pain. And that brings us into the second movement of this dark symphony. Verse 11 says, why did I not perish at birth and die as I came from the womb? Why were there knees to receive me and breasts that I might be nursed? For now I would be lying down in peace. I would be asleep and at rest with the kings and rulers of the earth, who built for themselves places now lying in ruins, with princes who had gold, but obviously in quotes, in parentheses, who no longer have it, who filled their houses with silver. Or why was I not hidden away in the ground like a stillborn babe? He's even saying, a stillborn babe, is it better than me? Like an infant who never saw the light of day. There the wicked cease from turmoil, and there the weary are at rest. Captives also enjoy their ease. They no longer hear the slave driver's shout. The small and the great are there, and the slaves are freed from their owners. So if you've ever heard someone have a death wish, this is that. Relief in Job's mind is spelled D-E-A-T-H. He sees in death it would be better. It would be at least a place of rest. And I think for us to have a bit of understanding, this is a very ancient document, likely one of the most ancient of the entire Bible. And in that era, they did not have a well-developed understanding of what happened after you died. They basically believed that you would simply go to a place of stillness and darkness. It later became known as Sheol. But it's a place of stillness and darkness, a place of nothingness, but the righteous and the unrighteous are there alike. If everyone is there, and Job says, that I actually look at as a rest. It's a rest from the suffering that I'm actually going through now. He says, death is looking really good right now. It claims rulers and princes, slaves and everyone alike, and everyone is equal in that. Death is the great equalizer. And he sees solace. He sees relief in it. And then in verse 20, he concludes, and this is the last part of this chapter, why is light given to those in misery and life to the bitter soul? To those who long for death that does not come, who search for it more than hidden treasure, who are filled with gladness and rejoice when they reach the grave? Why is life given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? For sighing has become my daily food. My groans pour out like water. What I feared has come upon me. What I dreaded has happened to me. I have no peace, no quietness. I have no rest, only turmoil. This I would summarize as just living misery. This is his diet of pain. The sigh is that, and the groan is, there's almost no words to describe it. He is in such dire misery. There's no hope. There's no comfort or solace. There's no resolve, no peace or quiet, and there is no end in sight. He says, what I feared most has completely enveloped me, and his sigh is the sigh of complete and utter defeat. And I think it's interesting that in this meditation, he says, even death has disappointed me by not coming for me. Even death has disappointed me. So, this is a real downer, isn't it? I mean, like, wow, take all you need. Let's go home and break up into groups of, you know, three and pray. What are we to make of this? I think there's some profound truths that are contained here. But what we see, firstly, is this is just pure humanity in pain, vented out honestly. And there's something incredibly profound and beautiful about humanity being really humanity, not being all bottled up. So let's take three different things and kind of break them down in terms of take-homes from this very dark chapter. Firstly, emotions and pain are part of being human. Emotions and pain are part of being human. Accept them. This is part of the message of the writers of wisdom literature and the Old Testament, that there's an emotive sense of processing these things before God and with others before God. And there's something very powerful about this. Now, my fighter pilot friend was very uncomfortable with his emotions. You could tell that very easily. Now, what I think is interesting with regard to emotions is that women typically have a leg up on this one. Because, not because you have more feelings than men do, but because it's okay to have those feelings and be a woman. Where for men, it's difficult because we have a hard time managing our feelings and still preserving our manhood, because somehow it's been taught to us that if we're emotive, if we experience emotion and somehow let that out, that somehow it will be wrong. We've heard the message, big boys don't cry. Have you ever heard that before? I have. I heard that from my dad. My dad was uncomfortable with emotion, so when I was crying, and I'm a feeler, and I was a crier, and so when I'm feeling and crying, my dad is scolding me for feeling and crying, and I'm crying more because he's scolding me. You know, it's like, this really isn't working. And this was all because he couldn't manage his emotions, and so he wouldn't accept them in me. And this is endemic to many family systems on the planet, that what we feel uncomfortable with, we superimpose on the next generation so that they cannot or are not allowed to actually go into a direction that we simply are uncomfortable with. But this was my dad. And I think that what ends up happening for a lot of guys in this is that we get all bottled up, and so the one emotion that is the sanction, the emotion of choice, is anger. And so we do, we're able to vent our anger and different kind of things like that because we think, well, this is at least the acceptable emotion for a guy because I can express anger and still preserve my manhood. False, wrong, not. No, what you see in the Bible is this beautiful, multidimensional kind of expression of feeling. Seriously, from the start of the Bible to the end, it's like there's a lot of emotion in there. And I think that many of us, let me say this, many of us are simply emotionally constipated. Yes, Bob did use the word constipated in church. That we are all bottled up. We think that somehow God doesn't want us to feel. He doesn't want us to feel anger. He doesn't want us to feel sorrow. He doesn't want us to feel anxious or afraid. He doesn't want us to feel joy, or maybe he does want us to feel joy, but we don't even know how to feel that because we don't know how to deal with feelings on the whole. That we don't know how to feel deeply moved by something or someone. We don't know how to feel disgust, although I think that one's a more natural one, or to experience hilarious laughter. But the reality is, and let me say this to you because it's what's in the Bible all over the place. God is comfortable with your emotions, even if you aren't. And he is not threatened. If you somehow blow a screw and you know, just like blow a gasket and you vent this out before God, not to someone, God forbid that, but to God, God is not like, oh no, the whole heavens are crumbling. The human is really upset. He's not. He's not upset by that. He's not disturbed by that. In fact, he meets you and I in that place of pain. But he's not threatened. He's not harmed. And he's completely literate because you got your ability to feel from your Creator. Your feelings did not come to you courtesy of the fall. They came courtesy of the image of your Creator. What? Yeah. You got these from your papa. The reality is that the Bible is a very honest book when it comes to emotion, and there's a remarkable range of emotional literacy within the pages of the Bible. Think for a moment. You've got, at the very beginning of Genesis, you have Cain and anger and murder. You have Abraham and fear and lying. You have Samuel and, you have Moses. Let's just go with Moses is frustrated and with God's people, cost him his ticket into the promised land. You've got David. I mean, he's just like a emotional festival, but he's a musician, so we can give him some grace on that. You've got Elijah, who experienced devastating depression and despondency and despair. And then moving into the New Testament, you have Jesus, and Jesus is emotional, and he's emotive. What happens when his friend Lazarus is dead, and he knows he's going to come and raise him from the dead? But he greets the sisters, and the sisters are devastated from their grief of the loss of their brother, and he's moved by their grief. It says in John's Gospel, twice he's moved to tears, and the shortest verse in your Bible says Jesus wept. He wept. The Apostle Paul, he's an emotive dude as well. I don't know that I would want to have him over to dinner at my house because he would be in my business. But here's what he says in this very emotive letter of 2 Corinthians. And I would encourage you to read this because it's very literate. Paul starts off the letter saying this: "We think you ought to know about the trouble we went through in the province of Asia. We were crushed overwhelmed by our ability to endure. Or literally beyond our ability to endure it. So I know that a lot of times people will say, well, God will never give you anything that's beyond your ability to endure. But Paul just says it right here. This was beyond our ability to endure. So think about that. And he said, we thought that we would never live through it. In fact, we expected to die. This is hard stuff. But it's interesting because there's this church that's sort of not really wanting a lot of relationship with Paul, and he's a shepherd to them, and he cares about them deeply. And he comes right out of the gate in 2 Corinthians very, very much letting his guard down, inviting them into relationship. And curiously, what ends up happening is as he lets his guard down, as he walks in transparency and he lets them see his pain, it does something to them. It creates connection with them. That when we actually let down our guard and we share our emotions, our pain, our joy, the full range of those things with people that we love, it creates connection and intimacy. For almost every marriage that I've ever come into contact with, including my own, it is that bearing of soul to one another. It is that letting down our guard and sharing emotions with each other that creates a intimacy that can't be broken, that creates a kind of joy, a kind of satisfaction. And quite frankly, it's one of the things that I hear constantly from ladies is that I wish my husband would just share what's going on inside of him, even if it's not pretty. But a lot of times we're just too stunted emotionally. And so the first thing is that emotions and pain are part of being human. And so if we're not actually allowing ourselves to accept them and experience them and perhaps express them in a constructive way, perhaps we're living subhuman. Perhaps. Secondly, that you can be completely honest with your God and trusted friends. And I say trusted friends because not everyone can handle all that's going on inside of you. So it needs to be people that you trust. But God can handle all of what's going on inside of you, your pain and your emotions. And so he invites us to bring them. That's what the lion's share of Psalms are about. The imprecatory Psalms are David just venting and bringing everything that he is. It's such a mess. It's so much emotion. And God just says, bring it, Dave. Bring it. Bring it all to me. Interact with me. It doesn't mean that, you know, when David says, I'm so upset, I want you to dash my enemies' kids' heads on rocks, the Lord's not going to take him up on that. But David is at least showing what's inside of him to his God. And it's very, very powerful. No, God wants all, he invites you close to them, to him, and he wants all the parts of you. Not just the sanitized parts, not just the religious parts, not just the sort of pseudo-sanctified parts. He wants you to bring all of what you are to him, all of it. But you don't understand, Bob, I've been saved for, you know, 50 years, and I can see how God would do that with a young believer, but with an old believer like me, it's like, well, you've just been stunted for the whole time, so get with the program. It's okay. He can handle you. He can handle it. He wants all of you. And there are at least four dynamics that I just want to hit very quickly here that I see within this. Firstly, that we're not designed to carry our pain alone. By your creator, you are not designed to carry your pain by yourself. And so when you choose to do it, you choose to do something that you were not designed to do. I love the way that the Apostle Peter writes it. He says, cast all your cares on him because he cares for you. In truth, you don't have enough strength to carry it by yourself. When you do, the body always wins. Something is going to pay for it when you hold it in. And you don't need to. I think it's one of the beautiful things about Alcoholics Anonymous. We have an AA meeting that meets here, you know, during the week. And I love the way that whole community thing goes on, that people say, I can't do this myself. I need God and I need others. I need God and I need others. I need God and I need others. Let me say it one more time. I need this myself. I need God and I need others. You need God, and you need others. Secondly, there's a cathartic or a releasing effect with when we are honest with God with what's really going on inside of us. Now, as we said, David is a feeler, King David. And in Psalm 32, this is the Message paraphrase of it. He said, "When I kept it all inside, my bones turned to powder. And then I put it all out. Then I let it all out. And suddenly the pressure was gone. My guilt dissolved and my sin disappeared." Now, he's talking about holding in the guilt of his sin and everything and the way that that works. But I think that this is more or less universal, that there's something powerful about speaking out our emotions, about being willing to express these things and putting words to them. Thirdly, it is part of being known by God and by others, that when we drop our guard, like I was just saying, that we let it all out with God, it allows God to connect with us, to know us. And this is different than God knowing a thought that you have before you have it, and he knows all of your feelings. This is different. This is you sharing your life with God, God sharing his life with you, and you actually getting to share an intimacy with God because now you have a shared life, not just an omnisciently known life. Does that make sense to you? Really important here. Because God knows everything that's going on with you, but until you share it with him, there's no relationship that's involved with it. And that's what he wants with you. So we bring it to him, and we expose it, and we now participate in relationship. And the last one of these little insights, as I think about it, is that allows us to come out of darkness and hiddenness. That hiding started in Eden. And it has kept on going ever since then, that we continually stuff and hide our pain, we hide our sin, we hide all these different things about us. But the enemy actually dwells in that hidden place and in the darkness of those things, that when we actually walk out into the light, now God's resources become ours. Until we do, the enemy can just continue to punch us out. And he does a credible job with it. What am I saying? Be honest with your God. I love this story that Ted Roberts wrote in his book, Pure Desire. He writes this: "A few years ago, our church had a huge summer picnic, and friends had talked me into joining one of the baseball games. And as I stood there trying to pretend that I knew what I was doing as a shortstop, a young man ran up to me on the field and yelled, 'Pastor Ted, Brian, your son just got hit in the head with a baseball bat.' Well, immediately, I turned and raced toward the other field where my son was. And I arrived on the scene, and my son looked terrible. Blood was everywhere. And as I pushed through the gathered crowd, a little girl standing beside her mom asked, 'Is he dead, Mom?' That was all I needed to hear. As I gathered my son into my arms, he slowly began to move. First one eye, then the other came into focus, despite all the blood and pain. And then he mumbled to me, I don't think I'm dead, Dad.' And with tears streaming down my face, I pulled him close and then rushed to a waiting van. And we sped to the hospital. His blood was everywhere, all over both of us. And I noticed he was trying not to cry and was in a lot of confusion, trying to process the trauma. And I simply said to him, 'Hey, buddy, now is the time that strong men cry. Weak men can't cry because they're afraid of their emotions. As real men, now it's time to let the tears flow and to start praying in the Spirit. Now is the time. Be honest. Be honest to God with everything that is inside of you." The third thing is something that needs to be talked about. I don't recall ever talking to a church about this before, but it is here. I need to talk to you for a moment about suicide, because it's a real thing. And the point that we see here is that thoughts of suicide are common. As I've talked with my wife and my daughter who are therapists, and I've had a lot of years in ministry, I've just heard that lots and lots and lots of us have these thoughts. Thoughts of suicide are common. Dwelling on it is not. So take them seriously and then let them go. So let me explain. That most of us have thoughts of suicide when we have been down. If we took a survey of people in the room who have actually experienced thoughts of suicide when we're down, that's this idea that somehow it would just be easier if it was just all over, that our hope is kind of run out, I think that we would find that actually most of us have at some point in time felt or thought those thoughts, that we simply want release and we can't see beyond it, and so we think of ending it. Those thoughts kind of blaze through and they last a few seconds or maybe an afternoon, but eventually we dismiss them because they're untrue. What makes them untrue is a little bit of processing help where we think, you know, there are people that I love. There are purposes that I still feel like are out in front of me that I want to work at. And then we think about, gosh, if I did this, what would it do to the people that I actually love? And after we spend a little bit of time doing that, we just realize that is so not worth it. And we dismiss the thoughts. However, for some of us, the thoughts persist. And they begin to, they so are persistent and they have this kind of major oppressive type of impact on us. And as we go through those things, we start to develop a little bit of a plan about how we might pull it off. This is called psychologically suicide ideation. And when those thoughts start getting space within you, it's time to get help. Let me say that again. When those kinds of thoughts, that intentional agreement with these thoughts, when that starts getting a hold of you, it's time to run up the surrender flag. It's time to get help. It's very serious. Not something that you want to play around with. Again, suicidal thoughts, not uncommon or are common. Suicidal ideation, you must take that seriously. And you must also understand that if you're in that space, you are never in that space alone. Now, you're probably thinking in a different way than I am, that the enemy is behind a lot of these thoughts. He's the one that takes your problems and your pain and helps them become misery, and then helps the misery become devastation, helps the devastation become the desire to end it all, help the desire to end it all, have a plan to end it all, and then eventually to follow through that no one ever commits suicide without the enemy of our souls being involved. No one. Not even one time. This is his will for you. And so anybody who has gone through this, the devil plays in this arena profoundly. And we know we're not ignorant of his schemes. Does that make sense? Important to say. I am not talked about this, but it's important, I think, for us to realize, because I think a lot of us are just afraid. It's like, gosh, I had a suicidal thought or a thought about suicide, and I must be somehow defective. No, you're not defective. It's not uncommon. But if this starts actually becoming a pattern, now that's something, that's a place where you need to get help. Bible scholar Marva Dawn, who I quoted a couple of weeks ago, she was in Africa, and she was discussing the book of Job with a group of tribal leaders. And as she asked them this question, "Do you think Job was courageous?" Well, instantly, the older tribal leaders said, "No, we believe that what Job has done and what he has said is shameful, and shames his family and shames his name." And after they had a chance to vent that, one of the younger men raised his hand. He said, "I have a different opinion. I think that Job is very courageous." And she said, "Why?" "Because he didn't take his life. He didn't take his life." So we see a death wish going on in Job in this, but he doesn't take his life. We see a person in just abject pain, physical pain, loss, and practically every arena that you can experience loss, and he doesn't take his life. But he does go through this. And so what we see from Job in this chapter, this third chapter of Job, is that emotions and pain are part of being human. And not a single one of us in this room has lived a pain-free life. We haven't. If you're drawing breath here, you've experienced some pain. You've experienced some sorrow. You've experienced some loss. If you're an adult here, it's impossible for you to get to this state without having some of that happen. And I would say that percentages hover right around 100% that all of us have experienced this. That's normal. And you have feelings that come with that, and I think we need to learn how to accept that. Gosh, I'm feeling very upset. I'm feeling very sad. I went through a period of time a little while ago, a couple of years ago, and the sadness was just profound. And it wasn't depression, it was just I was sad. And people, when people found out that I was sad, they're like, well, can we pray for you and make the sadness go away? And people tried to pray it off of me, still sad. And sat with the Lord and he's like, I'm sad too, Bob. I'm sad about those things that you're sad about too. Those things affect me, they impact me as well. I feel that pain with you. Oh. So it's okay to be sad like this? Yeah, it's okay. And I got through it. But I had to accept it to get through it. Secondly, that you can be completely honest with God and trusted friends with your pain and your emotions. I'd say bring them. Bring them. Bring them. And lastly, thoughts of suicide are common. Dwelling on it is not. And so take them seriously and then let them go. Take them seriously and then let them go. Does that make sense? Go like this. All right? That I think that a lot of times we think, gosh, if we have those thoughts, that means that somehow something's wrong with us. It's like, no, I have thoughts about all kinds of things. That doesn't mean that they own me. So, not exactly an uplifting message today. But the reality is that as we become emotionally literate, as we accept who we are, made by our Creator in His image, all of it, what happens is we are able to experience greater joy. We're able to experience sorrow, and it doesn't ruin us. It's part of being human. And I realized that when in my period of sadness that I was able to enter into a relationship with God that I had never had before, into a depth of connection with Him that was never even available to me. Because I actually allowed Him into my sorrow, and He shared it with me, and even shared some of His with me. And so I am glad for that. So what am I saying? Well, a couple of things. This is a cliche. You've probably heard it before, but if you're going through hell, keep going. Let the Lord have everything that you got. Bring it all to Him. What might that look like? You might just need to go out for a walk and scream your lungs out with all that's going on inside of you. I have done this. Felt surprisingly good to have no voice at the end. Bring it all to Him. All of it. All of it. Sanitized and unsanitized parts as well. If you're going through hell, keep going. Don't build a house there. And the last thing is, the only way out is through. The only way out of the pain is through it. It's not avoiding it. Let's stand up.